Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you're looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under podcasts. It's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Stephen Thompson, filling in for Linda Holmes, as she vacations in a place even colder than this one. This week on Pop Culture Happy Hour, we delve into the new second season of the Netflix original series, House of Cards. We talk about Portent Power and Kevin Spacey scheming into the camera. Then it's on to an old favorite of ours as we check in on some new pop culture punching bags. Entertainers we love, no matter how much the culture at large has turned its back. And then we close, as always, with what's making us happy. Before we get things started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table and meet the newly reconstituted Pop Culture Happy Hour crew. Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I poke about in the vicinity of theater and movies and that sort of thing.
Glenn Weldon, how about you? What do you do for NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And behold, Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and social media producer for Code Switch, the team that reports on race and culture.
Well, it is good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, we are taping this on Tuesday, and this past weekend, Netflix launched its entire 13-episode second season of House of Cards. Now, who here, I'm going to do a little poll around the table, who here has already gobbled up the whole thing?
Me.
That'd be me.
I have two episodes left.
Mm-mm. Wow. I am way further behind than that. But I had never seen season one.
Right.
I hesitate as the least informed person here to get the ball rolling, but we sort of decided up front that I would be like a control a control group who was not exposed to season one and tried to jump in just head first into season two.
And how'd that go?
It actually went, I thought, very, very smoothly compared to other, I'm usually the one who gets thrown in head first, having not seen the first 06 seasons of Mad Men or whatever, and trying to catch up on what all the portent means. This I found very, very easy, very easy to jump in. We should just provide a little bit of backstory on what House of Cards is. It is a Washington, D.C. based political intrigue laden TV drama.
When the season one begins, the main character, Frances Underwood, is the majority whip in the House.
Played by Kevin Spacey.
Played by Kevin Spacey. And by the end of season one, he has manipulated and schemed his way to a rather higher position of authority. And that's where we begin with season two.
Right. One of the first things I always look for when I'm trying on a new drama is, how do they handle exposition? How much of the exposition is spat out in chewy bundles, like in newscasts or voiceover? This show, as many people know, has its way of dealing with that, is to occasionally just have the action behind Kevin Spacey just stop, turns his head, and just speaks into the camera. Usually some kind of wry comment on how he's about to put something over on someone.
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted.
So basically what we are seeing in this show, the overall arc of the show, is this guy's rise to power.
Yes. Uh-huh. One of the phrases he keeps coming back to in this season is ruthless pragmatism. He is, in his way, a dedicated public servant. Like, he does good things sometimes, but he is very, very serious that nobody's going to get in his way.
Right. One of the things the show gets right about D.C. kind of helped you, Stephen, because like in D.C., people cycle off and on. Administrations come and go. Mm-hmm. People get out of the city, and it's a very transient city. So a lot of the characters we got to know from season one have been cycled out over the course of season two.
Because there's been an election.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So at the top of the new season, we're filled in on how the election has gone and what the new state of affairs is.
There's been the occasional death. Okay. It's that kind of show.
Kat, what do you think of House of Cards?
You know, I spent all weekend watching all but two episodes of the second season, and it was so easy to get pulled into this dark and tense world that they have there. One of the biggest things that stuck out to me that kept bothering me is, so you have Kevin Spacey as Frank Underwood, who has now this newly found power, and yet it seems like he is one of the only people who always gets his way. I mean, it's not always perfect, and you have all of these other players starting to emerge in the second season, giving him a run for his money, but it drives me crazy that a show that is so built on power has so many people who seem completely powerless.
Now, who can't keep up with this guy?
That's a great point that even just a few episodes in, I was starting to feel like, is this guy always going to be the smartest guy in the room?
Because that's the conceit of the show, except, of course, eventually we will get to the point where his hubris takes him too far, because that's how these stories always work, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, also, this season, they've really expanded the role of Gerald McCraney. So Gerald McCraney plays a businessman by the name of Tusk who presents a worthy adversary to Frank over the course of the season. The other thing, you know, we talk about what this gets right and wrong about D.C. I've been in this town 20 years. The times I've heard anybody in my circle mention the word power is zero, unless they're talking about Pepco. Otherwise, because this is a very granular city. This is a very nerdy city. It's wonky. Yes. People talk about the chairmanship of committees. They talk about, you know, being able to control the votes. If you go to dinner parties in the city, people are talking about cloture more than you would hear anywhere else.
Is that entirely true, though?
Well, see, this is what I'm saying.
Just never been my experience. I've only been here 8 years. But
when it gets to the layer of, you know, whipping votes and all that kind of stuff, that's when it feels real to me. When he pulls back and does the sort of J.R. Ewing power versus money, that's when it doesn't feel like it feels... I still think that this has this soap opera aspect to it. Veep is the one.
I was going to say, Veep is my favorite.
It sort of gets that little bit of the ridiculous that's
the
mixed
grasping. And then the petty, the grasping.
And then where does Scandal fall in DC dramas?
I haven't seen that. I
Scandal
think that's probably
is a lot
Steven
like
Silver.
This.
But it's I have not seen Scandal either. I mean, House of... And if Gene Demby were here, I would imagine we would get a large treatise on Scandal. But how does the pulpiness of this, which is, I'm assuming, a little more portentous and serious, whereas Scandal is a little sillier and soapier?
Yeah. So I would say that in both shows, House of Cards and Scandal, the presidents are these kind of useless people who things happen to them, but they don't really do anything. They don't run the country, so to speak. Other people are running the country. Other things are happening. Crises happen. They get fixed. And then all of a sudden, the plot lines go away. They disappear. It's like a road that just has ended and you're standing at the edge wondering where it happened.
Yeah, that's one of the big criticisms about this show in particular is that the stories are driven by events that don't necessarily have a whole lot of consequence.
The pacing of this show is weird because individual episodes happen very slowly, but there's a lot of advancement of the plot in between episodes in many cases. When you binge watch, it feels like this is moving along, barreling along. But I really keep coming back to the performances because it is the performance of Robin Wright as Claire, who has a...
Now, she is Kevin Spacey's wife on the show, and she very ruthlessly runs a nonprofit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
She has a stillness to her. It has nothing to do with calmness or being comfortable in your own skin. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with being a leopard on the Serengeti, and everybody who comes into your eyeline is a gazelle. It's just that kind of stillness.
She is phenomenally good in this part, and she got a lot of praise last year, but she didn't really get the greatest material to work with.
Right.
This season, they've done a lot more to develop the backstory of that relationship, why they're so strange, why they're so ruthless, and why she's so icy, and why he's so much of her protector. So if you're only two or three episodes in, you won't know this, but you will learn more about her, and you will see some vulnerability that you didn't see in the first
season.
Yeah, it's
great. And there's something about their partnership that you learn throughout the second season that is both heartwarming and scary and tense.
Oh, terrifying.
one of the things that made me more uncomfortable over the shady, crazy dealings that happened, you know, the deaths, the backwater channeling that went on, was the fact that Frances Underwood and Claire never seemed to relax. I mean, even when they were relaxing, they were still in suits, and there was just the stiffness.
Well, and the music is going.
Yeah. In the first season, you see Frances working out in a suit, and I mean, eventually, every now and then they change into normal clothing. But I mean, to me, that just made them seem so far from normal and relatable.
That's perfectly intentional. Her posture when she's in these very, very, very tight dresses is about artifice. It's about projecting this image.
There is a line that he has about her. He says she has armor 3 inches thick. That is so explicit in the costume design for the show, which is all of a piece with the performances and with the sort of general matte finish gorgeousness of this cinematography in this show. It is such a beautiful show to look at.
I mean, you have big time filmmakers involved in this project. I mean, David Fincher is kind of the at the top, and you have major directors directing these episodes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The second season does what a second season should, which is widen out and show us the world around them in ways that both succeed and not. I really love the addition of Molly Parker as Jackie Sharp, a character.
Cosine.
Jackie Sharp. She plays the new whip, or as he says, whip in Congress. And she is just a rounded character. You know, there's a moment where that character does something, and then several episodes later, she explains why she does it. And I was talking to my brother and sister-in-law this weekend, because they were behind me in terms of in terms of the episodes, and they mentioned that she did this thing, and they were wondering why she did it. And of course, it was exactly the reason that she later explains, which mm-hmm. tells me, what does that tell me? That tells me that that piece of foreshadowing was enough, that you didn't need
yeah.
this other
right.
explanation at the
end. And there are some other examples of foreshadowing that made me go, sitting, jumping up and down in my chair, and when they paid off.
Yeah.
In particular, a piece of foreshadowing involving the Underwoods and the youngish Secret Service
yes.
agent on their detail.
Well, come on over and join the party.
Haven't you got sick of seeing my face yet?
Never, ma'am. To meet him. For his loyalty and service.
To Edward.
My Facebook and Twitter feeds blew up.
Well, see, okay, you mentioned your Facebook and Twitter feeds, and I think this is where we should talk about this. This was all dumped at the beginning of a, mm-hmm. of President's Day weekend. Yep. Very smart timing.
Also the weekend of Valentine's
right.
Day.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy yeah. Valentine's Day. Let's sit on the couch and watch 13 hours of intrigue. It was interesting, like, how quickly my Twitter feed just started just chattering about it as if it was assumed that the second this thing got
yeah,
made available to the public,
are so rude.
We're all lined up and watching it. And like,
I
still haven't gotten through all of Orange is the New Black. And obviously I can't expect to stay unspoiled. I can't expect society to never spoil anything that I'm too lazy to have gotten around to seeing. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, like what is the grace period before people can start chattering about this, because for many people that grace period was 0 seconds.
Yeah, 10 minutes. I mean, so I stayed off of social media for the weekend because I didn't want it to get ruined. I think mm-hmm. I would have been really upset, and that would have ruined the whole weekend. But also at the same time, it was really hard not to go on and have someone to confide in, because I was feeling
confide in as if it is an actual thing happening to you
no.
in your life.
When I watch TV shows, especially when I binge watch them, I get so invested, like and I would just want someone to confide in. But when you're watching a show that drops all at once, you don't know where anyone's at, so it kind of feels like you're in this sort of secret society. And yeah. I mean, I imagine you two, Trey and Glenn, are Do you guys feel lost because you finished it so soon?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm just looking forward to the third season. I will say that, you know, Netflix doesn't release numbers of people who watch it. They
no.
just don't do that. Yeah. But we were at dinner. The waiter overheard us talking about it. I said, oh, really? And we kind of got into it. Now, we were in Westchester, Pennsylvania, the unbearable whiteness of just the center of the universe. But it really seemed like there was a lot of chatter, not just online, but there were people around us talking about it as well.
Can we talk about something that we've touched on before a little bit? The notion of anti-heroes and why we like to watch them or don't like to
yeah,
watch
are
them.
We supposed to root for Kevin Spacey, who is at times, I mean, you talked about, well, you know, in some ways he's an effective public servant, mm-hmm. but he's also just very cavalierly destroying people's lives mm-hmm. for very selfish reasons.
He's the Iago of the story. And as things like Iago and Richard III demonstrate, villains are fun to watch when they're at the top of their game.
All right, well, find us on Facebook and Twitter and weigh in on what you think. Please, 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 no spoilers. We have tried to remain as spoiler-free as possible, even talking about first season business.
Right.
So you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH to give us your thoughts on House of Cards. All right. Well, our next topic is a subject near and dear to our hearts. I think we've done enough rounds of this that sometimes they can be a little tricky even to come up with. But we've got, as I'm looking straight across the room at Trey Graham.
It's true. I spent half the afternoon racking my brains to find another Andrew Lloyd Webber to talk about.
an Andrew Lloyd Webber, a pop culture punching bag.
Right.
For some, not all. People are very quick to rag on these people.
Uh-huh.
And we are here to lift them up.
A throaty defense.
A throaty defense of the seemingly indefensible. Mm-hmm. Glenn, why don't you kick us off?
Well, before I get to mine, I wanted to know if any of us had chosen Shia LaBeouf.
No. Okay. But I like where you're going.
Because here's a guy who is, in the zeitgeist of the moment, the pop culture punching bag. Yeah. You will not find a throaty defense of this guy anywhere.
Because?
Because he made a short film called Howard Cantor, which he ripped off from a comic, a 2007 comic by Daniel Clowes called Justin M. Damiano.
Shot for shot.
Right.
Scene for scene.
Scene for scene. Now, you know, I wanted to mount some kind of intellectual defense of this guy.
Oh, now, and keep in mind, it's not just that he plagiarized this comic book.
No.
It's the way he has gone about trying to resuscitate himself.
He has proceeded to do this ongoing performance art project of apologizing for plagiarism by plagiarizing apologies. That's what this guy is
yep.
doing. I mean, I get it. I don't want it. You can keep it, but I get it.
Is it performance art, or is he just a complete D-bag?
It certainly feels like it. The reason I can't defend this guy, even in theory, is because he stole from Daniel Clowes.
Right.
Daniel Clowes is an indie comics creator who is making little comics, and A...
whose work, by the way, is so good.
Absolutely. Daniel Clowes deserves more attention to his work, more money thrown at his feet. Shia LaBeouf deserves less of both. Here's a guy, Daniel Clowes, who does not need his reflexive disdain of the world fed by some Hollywood D-bag. But he did it anyway. But there's a new wrinkle in this, because just this last week, Shia LaBeouf staged an exhibition at an L.A. gallery.
Oh, yes.
In which he ripped off Marina Abramović's installation piece, whatever
really?
Of The Artist is Present, whereby mm-hmm. you go into the gallery, you sit down at a table across from Shia LaBeouf, he's wearing the bag that says, I'm not famous anymore, on his head, and you sit there and you stare and you come to some, I don't know.
And you
experience nirvana.
You are able to interact with him in some way. Now, this is so willfully pretentious and up its own butt that I can't really get behind it. But two people over the weekend had some good reactions to it. Two people who actually went to this exhibition, sat in that chair, had some, I thought, thoughtful reactions to it, both named Jordan, weirdly. Jordan Morris on the podcast Jordan Jesse Go, great mm-hmm. podcast Jordan Jesse Go, had a really thoughtful reaction, I thought. So you can find that on the episode of that podcast that has the guest Bill Burr, who does not have a particularly thoughtful reaction to that. It's a very gut-level reaction to it. Also, on Thought Catalog, a writer by the name of Jordan Firstman had a really thoughtful reaction to it.
Do you have a defense of Shia LaBeouf?
I don't.
Have you heard a useful defense of Shia
both
LaBeouf?
Of those things.
Besides calling attention to the work of Dan Clowes?
No. Well, actually, that's some small benefit.
I mean, I reach a point when somebody gets pounded on enough.
Right.
And that's some of the notes that I took for this piece was like, who are the punching bags and how can I defend them? Because I hate it when people become shorthand
right.
for a thoughtful discussion of why we do and don't like things. Now, I mentioned last week on the podcast that I had done an episode of All Songs Considered on the worst songs of all time, which was in turn inspired by this piece that I did for the All Songs Considered blog called Leave We Built This City Alone. And it was not a full-throated defense of Starship's 1985 horror show We Built This City, but it was trying to reset the discussion of what the worst song of all time is so that you can't just knee-jerk say, it's We Built the City by Starship, right. End of discussion.
Make an argument, not just count on received knowledge.
And I think what's so frustrating about Shia LaBeouf is the fact that, I mean, and disclaimer, I used to love him on that Disney show, Even Stevens.
Sure.
It was one of my favorites growing up. But the thing about him is that he just seems so self-aware about all of this. And it's just feeding into this cycle. And I almost wonder, I mean, obviously it's intentional, but I wonder how much of this he really wants. I mean, and I think he wants the Matthew McConaughey trajectory, you know, where he's pigeonholed in one thing and just wants to emerge as butterfly.
That's an interesting point, because Shia LaBeouf is not an untalented guy. I mean, I first encountered him I used to watch Project Greenlight on HBO, mm-hmm. and he is the star of this sort of misbegotten movie that they're trying to make, and it's all about how this guy is potentially kind of the next thing, and he seemed like a very kind of like a sweet, likable kid, mm-hmm. and I definitely found myself rooting for him.
Right. Okay, so that's not my guy. That's not the one I chose. For reasons that I just can't mount a defense. But what are some of your guys? What do you guys pick as punching bags?
How about Kat?
Okay, so over this winter break, I was with my family, and all of a sudden, we just started watching the Fast and the Furious franchise. Mm-hmm. And movie after movie after movie. And I had always been a Justin Lin film, you know, from his first one, Shopping for Fangs, and then Better Luck Tomorrow. And something about those movies I could always relate to because, you know, you have these Asian American characters and I write about that stuff. But no, I mean, Fast and Furious is not the type of movie that I normally watch. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's horrible. Tokyo Drift had like 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. More like 26 or whatever that
last,
number is.
The last one is actually reasonably highly regarded.
Yeah, and they've picked up steam. But something about that franchise just has a little space in my heart. And I don't know if it's because I think Sung Kang is a total hottie or something about the way each plot is the same. There's really no plot. And Vin Diesel and who's that other guy? The Rock? When they fight? When Vin Diesel and The Rock fight in one of the movies, and I can't even get it straight which one.
I don't think it matters.
Which installment? Yeah, it doesn't matter. But it was like these two superheroes were just going at it.
Took me a while to find that tracking chip.
But not as long as I flipped the receiver. You're going down, Toretto.
I'm right here.
It was really enjoyable to me. And, I mean, you can talk about how there's no movement in it, but, I mean, to me, that's one of the few things that my family could bond together over that I really enjoyed.
Well, you bring up an interesting point about Fast and the Furious, which is that in action movie world, it has one of the more diverse casts.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very diverse cast.
I think as the director, Justin Lin was very intentional about the diverse cast that he had. You had people who looked Latino, Asian, Black, and mm-hmm. it seemed kind of like a global movie.
Well, and the global box office would bear that out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, indeed.
Which is actually, I mean, that's a very, very savvy move. This thing is going to mm-hmm. play all around the world.
Yep.
It's not just all blue-eyed right. white people.
It's got big explosions.
And big explosions.
And
big
fast
explosions.
Cars.
Fast cars and lots of interesting people. I don't have much to say about him or why I always have a soft spot for him, but speaking of punching bags, Vin Diesel has taken some heat over the last 6 months. But I like that guy. I like that big, lunky meathead.
Trey, give me a quick synopsis. Why is everyone mad at Vin Diesel?
Oh, there were a couple of viral videos where people were assuming that he was drunk or high or losing control of his life. But it looked to me like a guy who was having fun.
I mean, my soft spot for Vin Diesel, of course, goes back to that he's the Iron Giant.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which made when he fought The Rock that even cooler.
Yeah.
That's true.
I'm still stuck on that.
You can picture
I'm going to go YouTube those videos.
I'd like to see The Rock fight the Iron Giant. I've certainly had that soft spot. For me, like one thing that I come back to, first of all, I have one in sports, and this is going to be like Trey talking about opera, and like nobody's going to say anything in response to this. I like Mel Kiper. Yeah. Mel Kiper is the ESPN draft analyst with a big pompadour who just prattles and prattles and prattles and prattles and rattles off. He has become shorthand for the sports yapping around the NFL and the NFL draft to the point where now it's like if you were saying, oh, I don't like this world, you say, I don't like Mel Kiper. I like Mel Kiper. I know none of you give a crap.
He sucks.
It is the equivalent of Trey talking about an opera singer he loves while the rest of us stare blankly. In music, what sometimes happens is there'll be an artist who makes a record I really love and then goes horribly off the rails and becomes synonymous with things that are terrible. And I feel the need to stand up and be like, you know what? I think A Rush of Blood to the Head by Coldplay is a great record. Mm-hmm. I think the song Yellow by Coldplay from their first album, unimpeachably great song. Coldplay now has become, as much as it is still a very, very popular band, it's not like, oh, they're a punching bag. They're critically a total punch.
Hit. Right.
The thing to do is bash Coldplay. If you go to any website ever, maybe not Coldplay.com. Saying you hate Coldplay now is like saying you don't own a TV.
Right.
And so I feel the need when when that happens to say, you know what? I think Coldplay has some pretty great songs. I'm not going to, you know, die on that hill for every single thing. A more recent example of a musician like this, at the Golden Globes, when Alex Ebert from the band Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros won the Golden Globe for Best Score, the guy stood up on stage and P. Diddy hugged him.
He was on a boat with me partying in St. Bart's. And now, here we are together.
He came up from behind me and unbuttoned my jacket and said, "Let it flow."
And I thought, everybody hates this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
I marked that moment as when I was going to have to start defending Alex Ebert of Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, whose music I really, really liked.
Yeah. Here's mine. Okay, you ready for mine?
All right, hit me.
I will do, in the Trey Graham tradition, I will name two things I didn't pick. Because I couldn't come up with an intellectual defense, one I believed in. I would stand up for Kesha.
Oh, you can stand up for Kesha.
Who I think is very smart. Mm-hmm. I think she sings songs about sex unapologetically and having fun, and as Trey Graham said, just having fun, in a way that her colleagues who are dudes get a free pass on completely, but this weird slut-shaming thing happens with her that is completely unfair.
Also, that's actually also true of, like, almost all women.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's a good
I would
point.
Say that.
But she gets this weird, dirty...
She does. No, that song that she does with Pitbull,
yeah.
I recommend tracking down the version where somebody extracted Pitbull from the song, and you realize that's a really good song.
Yeah. But I don't like her music, so I can't really defend it.
Fair.
David Lynch's Dune. Ultimately, I couldn't come out in defense of it because the things that people hate about it, if we Venn diagram the things I love about it, it's a circle. Because I love the very things that people hate. I love its cheesiness. I love its bat poop craziness. I love its stiffness. I love this incredible weird approach to voiceover, which is all throughout the film because they're trying to stitch together a plot with stuff that they'd never filmed. So it's like, the shout-out mapes. For no reason. People just say that. But ultimately, that's a taste thing. What I chose was the 2008 film by the Wachowskis, Speed Racer. This is a film that was pilloried by the press, ignored by the public. It made $98 million worldwide, cost $120, considered a flop. It was dismissed as a glossy, candy-colored spectacle, and which I say to it, it was a glossy, candy-colored spectacle. It looks amazing. I mean, candy-colored is right. I mean, you will get eye diabetes from watching this
eye
thing.
Eye diabetes.
You will. And it also, let's back up a step here. It's called Speed Racer. The plot is that there is a family of race car drivers whose last name is Racer. So if you come at it thinking it's going to be anything but what it is, you're going to be, this is not My Dinner with Andre, this is a Speed Racer. Based, of course, on the 60s anime series, and it's just the best example of that, the best version of it. Now, you will, as I say, the color just pops really brightly, and the special effects are amazing. You will want to hear somebody kind of going, "Sugar Crush, Divine," as you're watching this thing. But the thing that doesn't work about it are the kid and the chimp. Spritel and Chim Chim.
The less you know about the movie, the happier you are.
I'm just saying. They are heat sinks. They take all the momentum from this film and just... But it is exactly what is wrong with the anime series from the 60s as well. So that is just a case of just adherence to the source
to the
material.
Text.
That's exactly. That's the thing. But it's just... It's got this sense of fun. It knows exactly what it is. So I am here to say you should, if you haven't seen Speed Racer, if, you just
if you're one of the few who somehow missed Speed Racer,
you should go back and check it out.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon, very much. Do you, dear listener, have a pop culture punching bag that you would like to defend? Would you like to launch a spirited defense of Shia LaBeouf?
Yeah, go ahead.
I urge you to go to our Facebook page and weigh in, which brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? I'm going to start with Kat Chow.
Oh, man. So I went skiing for the first time recently, and...
And you were not in a comical full-body cast.
Nope.
No, I mean, but my body feels sore. I can hardly move my arms. But one thing to know about me is that I have this terrible fear of heights. But so you can imagine that skiing probably wouldn't be on the top of my list. But I said I would do it, and so I went recently. But the interesting thing is that I have this other big fear of chairlifts. And
I wonder if the two are somehow related.
Yeah, I wonder why.
It's like having a fear of heights and a fear of rooftops.
And so
you just developed this fear of chairlifts, because how often does chairlifts come up in your life?
Right.
Yeah,
maybe
so
the band chairlift.
It was happening as I was getting on it, though. I didn't actually sit on the chairlift correctly. And so it was going up, and I turned to my boyfriend, who I was skiing with, and I said, oh my God, I'm not on the chairlift, okay? I'm not on it all the way. And I mean, I reached this point with the height thing where I realized the worst that could happen is that I'm going to die, or I can just drop off of it right now, immediately, and just lose all humiliation whatsoever. And so, you know, skiing.
So, which did you choose?
I think I died.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No,
speaking to us from beyond the grave.
I mean, I dropped off of it, I mean, with maybe 3 or 4 feet off the ground. So it wasn't bad, but I kind of conquered a fear.
Excellent.
You at least lived.
I lived.
Trey Graham, what do you got?
Well, speaking of Kat's having survived her ski trip, I have a happy ending. The 3-foot-long, 21-pound cat named Pickles, who was for some time a resident of a Massachusetts animal shelter, has found a home. Pickles is gigantic, and he is awesome because, see above, 3 feet long and 21 pounds. Because cats rule the internet. Come on, let's be honest.
True.
A more serious ending, and a well-earned one, but one that also constitutes a discovery for me. Mavis Gallant, Canadian-born writer, mostly of short stories, and her death made the news this week. I, like Glenn, love a good, closely observed short story, mm-hmm. and the appreciations I have been reading of Mavis Gallant made me want to pick up some of her stuff. She's apparently thought of widely in that school of, you know, sort of Alice Munro and
yep.
beautifully spare, carefully chosen words. And I downloaded a copy of her collected Paris stories, and I have started to read it this afternoon.
Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Walden, what do you got?
The Australian comic Claudia O'Doherty, or she would say Claudia O'Doherty, has a 3-episode web series called What is England?
Hello, I'm Claudia O'Doherty, actor and illusionist. I've come to England to make some travel videos on behalf of my family's business, O'Doherty World Travel. The company is in trouble because people have realised that you can just book your holiday yourself on the internet and save a lot of time and money. I'm staying in the home of a real English couple, my cousin Sarah and her husband Matt, Mark. They don't mind having me here. That's good. But why would I leave my busy and stimulating career as an actor and illusionist to make some dumb travel videos? Allow me to show you why.
Okay, and she proceeds to do that. This was tough to clip. A lot of this video is visual. The conceit here is that she's conceited. She's a horrible, conceited actor. And if there is one species of humor that's always going to get me, it is that one. This is so funny. Again, you should really check it out. But there's only 3. They're each like 5 or 6 minutes long. What is England? By Claudia O'Doherty.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. As I mentioned last week, I am completely and utterly up to my eyeballs in a project that I will be talking about soon enough, The 100 Songs from South by Southwest. You can download it. It's like 200 hours of work. I can, however, forward promote next week's episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, in which we will be recording our Oscars omnibus. Mm-hmm. This guy, who is it? This guy has seen every Best Picture nominee, mm-hmm. every acting nominee, and every screenplay nominee. Over the weekend, I powered through Wolf of Wall Street, which was only screening at 10:20 p.m. at the local. This movie is 2 hours and 59 minutes long. Uh-huh. So I powered through Your Wolf of Wall Street, and I topped it off, not the same night, with a little August Osage County, which we will thankfully not be talking about next week. It is 2 hours of actors yelling at each other, and it did not make me happy. I kind of loathed it.
Yep. Or as I said when I tweeted, I'm not from the Midwest, I'm from the Deep South, but those dinner party scenes, Tuesday at my family's house.
I know, it's like,
oh man, it's just a whole bunch of people acting at each other.
Exactly.
Not my cup of tea. see at all. But its completion is making me delighted. And the other thing that I would throw out there is we are finally hitting a time of year. There's kind of a long lull in music, particularly at the end of a given year, where there's very little in the way of new releases. And then at the beginning of the year, you start to get a trickle of sleeper. Well, this particular week that we are recording is when all of a sudden you can hear, like, big records by big artists, at least in my little world. And if you go to the NPR Music website, we put up, I know I'm just promoting NPR business here, but a really wonderful new album by Beck,
yep,
in the spirit of his 2002 masterpiece, Sea Change. It's some of the same musicians. It's very slow. It's very beautiful. It's heartbreaky and gorgeous. We put up an album-length stream of the new album by St. Vincent, mm-hmm, which is unbelievably inventive and exciting and just pops out of every corner of the speaker. Really nice new records by The Nawtwist and Death Vessel and Nena Cherry, her first solo album in 18 years. There's just a ton of amazing, like, more music than I have time to even ingest. I mean, February is such a dismal month in a lot of ways, but in terms of new music, it is the Garden of Eden. And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham. That's Trey with an E. Graham, exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon. That's WELDON. You can follow Kat Chow at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow our absent pal Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. That's Jessica_REEDY. You can follow our producer Lauren Migaki at L Migaki. That's MIGAKI. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here next week with our Oscars Omnibus. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. If you're looking for something new to listen to, there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including great interviews, highlights from the week's news, storytelling, and entertainment. Browse them all on iTunes under Podcasts.